Whereupon the man, still dull, measured Joseph from head to foot, as though even after this explanation he had something to say about whether he would let him in or no. Then he beckoned them up, still with the air of himself deciding not to refuse. Hastily the messenger once more charged Joseph that he must pant and gasp for breath when he came before Pharaoh, to impress the king with the fact that he had run the whole way to his countenance without pause. Joseph did not take him seriously. He thanked the long-legged one for fetching and accompanying him, and mounted the stairs to the official, who did not nod, but shook his head by way of greeting, but then invited Joseph to follow him. They paced the gaily colored vestibule, which had landscapes on the walls and four ornamental columns wound with ribbons, and arrived at a fountain hall likewise shining with pillars, this time of rare polished woods. Here there was a guard of armed men. It opened in front and at the sides into wide pillared passages. The man led Joseph straight ahead through an antechamber with three deep doors in a row, and they entered through the middle door into a very large hall, with perhaps 12 columns supporting a sky-blue ceiling painted full of flights of birds. A little open house in red and gold, like a garden belvedere, stood in the center. In it, a table surrounded by armchairs with colored cushions. Aproned servants were sprinkling and brushing the floor, clearing away fruit plates, looking after the incense vases and lamps on tripods alternating with wide-handled alabaster vases. They rearranged the chased gold beakers on the buffet and plumped up the cushions. It was clear that Pharaoh had eaten here and then withdrawn to some place to rest, either in the garden or somewhere in the house beyond. To Joseph, this was all much less new and astonishing than his guide probably supposed, for he looked at him sideways from time to time. "Do you know how to behave?" he asked, as they left the hall on their right, and entered a court with flower beds and four basins let into the pavement. "More or less, if I have to," answered Joseph with a smile. "Well, you have to now," retorted the man. "You know at least how to salute the god." "I wish I did not," replied Joseph, "for it would be pleasant to learn it of you." The official kept a straight face for a moment. Then abruptly and unexpectedly, he laughed. Then he pulled his long face that had gone so suddenly broad and was sober again. "You seem to be a sort of joker," he said, "a rascal and horse thief who can make a man laugh at his tricks. I suppose your gift of interpreting is a trick, too, like something you see a quack do at a fair." "Oh," answered Joseph, "I can't tell you much about interpreting. I haven't had much to do with it. It is not my line. It just happens by accident, and up to now I have not made much of it. But since Pharaoh called me in such haste on account of it, I have begun to think better of it myself." "That is meant for me, I take it?" asked the man. "Pharaoh is young and gentle and full of kindness. That the sun shines on a man is no proof that he is not a rascal." "It not only shines on us, it makes us shine," answered Joseph as they went on. "Some in one way, some in another. May you shine in yours." The man looked at him sideways. Then he looked straight ahead. But after that, suddenly, as though he had forgotten something and had to give another look at what he had seen before, he turned his head back to Joseph. At length the latter was compelled to return the side glance. He did so smiling and with a nod, as one who would say, "Yes, yes, don't be surprised. You are seeing straight." Quickly, and as it were startled, the man turned away again and stared before him. From the court with the flower beds, they reached a passage lighted from above, where the wall on one side was painted with scenes of harvesting and sacrifice, while the other, through columned doorways, gave glimpses of various rooms. Here was the entrance to the hall of council and audience. The guide pointed it out to Joseph as they passed. He had become more talkative. He even told his companion where Pharaoh was to be found. "They went into the Cretan loggia after luncheon," he said. "They call it that because some such foreign artist from across the sea did the paintings. He has the chief royal sculptors with him now, Beck and Auta, and is instructing them. And the great mother is there. I will hand you over to the chamberlain in the anteroom and have him announce you." "Yes, let us do so," said Joseph. And there was no more than that to what he said. Yet, as they went on, The man at his side first shook his head, and then again suddenly fell into a soundless, prolonged chuckle, almost spasmodic, which visibly shook his diaphragm in sudden jolts. He seemed not to have quite got it under control when they reached the antechamber at the end of the passage. A little stooped courtier in a wonderful frilled apron, with a fan on his arm, detached himself from the crack of a portiere embroidered with golden bees, where he had stood listening. The guide's voice still shook with suppressed chuckles. It went up and down quaintly as he announced his companion to the chamberlain, tripping mincingly toward them. "Ah, the much-heralded know-it-all," said the little creature in a high pipe with a lisp. "He who is wiser than all the scholars of the book-house. Good, good, exquisite," said he, still stooping, either because he was born like that and could not stand up straight, or because the exaggerated punctilio of court life had fixed him in this posture. "I will announce you at once. Why shouldn't I? The whole court is waiting for you. I will interrupt Pharaoh, whatever he is saying, in the middle of his instruction to his artists, to tell him you have arrived. Maybe that surprises you a bit, eh? Let us hope it does not bewilder you and make you utter follies, though you may easily utter them anyhow without that. I call your attention beforehand to the fact that Pharaoh is extraordinarily sensitive to any stupidities told him about his dreams. I congratulate you. Your name was..."
"My name was Osarsif," answered the other.
"You mean your name is Osarsif, of course. Extraordinary to be called that all the time. I will go to announce you by your name. Merci, my friend," said he, with a shoulder shrug, addressing Joseph's guide.
The man went away, and the chamberlain slipped through the curtains. From inside, subdued voices could be heard, a youthful one, gentle and shy at once. It paused. Probably the hunchback had minced and lisped himself close to Pharaoh's ear. Now he came back, his eyebrows high, and whispered,
"Pharaoh summons you."
Joseph went in. A loggia received him, not large enough really to be called, as they did call it, a garden house, but of most unusual beauty. Its roof was supported by two columns inlaid with colored glass and sparkling stones, and wound with painted garlands so well executed that they seemed real. The floor was laid in tiled squares of alternating design, cuttlefish, and children riding on dolphins. The whole place looked out through three large openings upon gardens, all of whose loveliness it thus embraced. There were glorious beds of tulips, strange exotic flowering shrubs, and paths strewn with gold dust that led to lily ponds. The eye ranged far out into a perspective of islands, bridges, and kiosks, and met the glitter of the faience decorations on a distant summer house. The loggia itself glowed with color. The side walls were covered with paintings unlike anything elsewhere in the country. Strange peoples and customs were depicted. Obviously these were landscapes from the islands of the sea. Women in gay, stiff clothing sat or moved about, their bosoms bare in their tight bodices, their hair curling above the ribbon on their foreheads and falling on their shoulders in long plaits. Pages attended them in strange, elaborate costume and handed drink from tapering jugs. A little prince with a wasp waist, parti-colored trousers, and lambskin boots, a coronet with a gay gush of feathers on his curly head, strutted complacently between rankly blossoming grasses and shot with his bow and arrow at fleeing game, which leaped away with all four hooves clear of the ground. Acrobats turned somersaults over the backs of raging bulls for the diversion of ladies and gentlemen looking down from balconies. In the same exotic taste were the objects of art and fine handicraft, bright enameled earthenware vases, ivory reliefs inlaid with gold, embossed drinking vessels, a steer's head in black basalt with gold horns and rock crystal eyes. As Joseph entered and raised his hands, his serious and modest gaze went the round of the scene and the persons of whose presence there he had been told. Amenhotep Nebmare's widow sat directly facing him, with her back to the light, throned on a lofty chair with a high footstool in front of the middle window embrasure. Her bronze-tinted skin, dark against the white garment, looked even darker in the shadow. Yet Joseph recognized her unusual features, having seen them various times on the occasion of royal progresses. The fine little aquiline nose, the curling lips framed in furrows of bitter worldly knowledge, the arching brows lengthened with the pencil above the small, darkly gleaming, coolly measuring eyes. The mother did not wear the gold vulture cap in which Joseph had seen her in public. Her hair was surely already gray, for she must have been at the end of her 50s, but it was covered by a silvery mob cap which left free the gold band of a strap over brow and temples, and from the crown of her head two royal serpents, two of them, as though she had taken over that of her husband, now with God, wreathed down and reared themselves in front of her brow. Round plaques adorned her ears, of the same colored precious stones that composed her necklace. The small, energetic figure sat very straight, very upright, and well knit, so to speak in the old hieratic style, the forearms on the arms of her chair, the little feet set close together on the footstool. Her shrewd eyes met Joseph's as he entered, but turned away again towards her son, after gliding swiftly down the newcomer's figure, in natural and even correct indifference, while the deep-graven, bitter lines round her prominent lips shaped a mocking smile at the boyish curiosity in his face as he looked towards the eagerly awaited and recommended arrival. The young king of Egypt sat in front of the left-hand painted wall, in an armchair with lion's feet, richly and softly cushioned, and with a slanting back from which he bent briskly forward, his feet under the seat and holding its arms with his thin, scarab-decked hands. It must be added that this posture of tense expectancy, as though to spring from his chair, this turn to the right while the veiled gray eyes went as wide open as they possibly could to look at the new interpreter of his dreams, this expressive series of changes did not happen all at once, but was carried out by stages and lasted a full minute. At the end, it really looked as though Pharaoh had lifted himself from his seat and was resting all his weight on the hands clutching the chair arms. Their knuckles stood out white. And thus, an object which had been in his lap, some sort of stringed instrument, fell with soft ringing and twanging to the floor, quickly retrieved and handed back by a man who stood before him, one of the sculptors he was instructing. The man had to hold it out a while until the king took it, closing his eyes and sinking back into the cushions in the same attitude which had obviously been his when talking with his artists. It was extraordinarily relaxed and easy, even too easy, for the chair seat was hollowed out to hold the cushions, and the cushions were too soft, so that he could not help sinking down. Thus he sat, not only leaning back, but also very low, with one hand hanging loosely over the back of the chair, and with the thumb of the other hand lightly touching the strings of the strange little harp in his lap. His linen-covered knees were drawn up and crossed, so that one foot went to and fro rather high in the air. The gold strap of the sandal ran between his great and his second toe. The Child of the Cave. Nefer-Kheperu-Re-Amenhotep was at that time just the age that Joseph, now standing before him, a man of 30, had been when he was feeding the flocks with his brethren and beguiled his father of the many-colored coat. In other words, Pharaoh was 17 years old. But he seemed older, not only because in his climate men ripen faster, not only because of his delicate health, but also because of his early obligations to the universe, the many impressions that, coming from all quarters of the heavens, had assailed his mind and heart, and finally, because of his zealous and fanatical concern anent the divine. In describing his face, under the round blue wig he wore today over the linen cap, the thousands of years' gap must not prevent the apt comparison. He looked like an aristocratic young Englishman of somewhat decadent stock. Spare, haughty, weary, with a well-developed chin, which yet somehow looked weak, a nose with a narrow, rather depressed bridge, which made even more striking the broad, sensitive nostrils, and deeply, dreamily overshadowed eyes, with lids he could never open quite wide. Their weary expression was in disconcerting contrast to the unrouged, morbid brilliancy of the full lips. There was a complicated and painful mixture of intellectuality and sensuality in this face, still in its boyish stage, with a suggestion of arrogance and recklessness. Pretty and well-favored it was, not at all, but of a disturbing attractiveness. It was not surprising that Egypt's people had a great tenderness for their pharaoh and gave him flowery names. Not beautiful either, indeed quite odd and unconformable to tradition, was Pharaoh's figure. It scarcely reached middle height. That was plain as it lay there in the cushions, clearly defined in its light, choice, costly raiment. The relaxed posture did not indicate a lack of manliness, but was a sustained attitude of opposition. There were the long neck and thin arms, the narrow, tender chest, half covered by a collar of priceless stones, the arms encircled by chaste gold bands, the abdomen, rather prominent from childhood, with the apron beginning well below the navel and reaching high up in the back, the rich frill in front, trimmed with the ureus and ribbon fringes. Add to all this that the legs were not only too short, but otherwise out of proportion, the thighs being distinctly too big, while the legs looked almost as thin as a chicken's. Amenhotep charged his sculptors not to disguise this peculiarity, but even, for the sake of truth, to exaggerate it. His hands and feet, on the contrary, were most delicate and aristocratic in shape, especially the hands, with their long fingers and sensitive expression. They had traces of unguent at the base of the nails. It was something to ponder on that the ruling passion of this spoilt lad, who obviously took for granted all the privilege and luxury of his state, was knowledge of the highest. Abraham's descendant, standing at one side and looking at Pharaoh, marveled to see in what diverse sorts of humanity, strange and remote one from another, concern for God could manifest itself on earth.